This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
We don't know anyone, and why is the predictor? SubhanAllah. I've been stretching this out for a while, hoping that the predictor would get up to show you the pictures. But that's all right, Jill. Next time. Okay, that's fine. So that's a bunch of things that happened in the fifth year, just before we come to the moment that we're going to talk about today. So once the Prophet ﷺ found out that 10,000 people were marching, making their way to Medina, he gathered the Sahaba as he always does, and he called upon them and said the thing that he says every time. فَقَالْ أَشِيرُوا عَلَيَّ أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ. Oh people, grant me your advice. Consult. I'm consulting you. I'm asking you for your opinions. What do we do? Where do we go? 10,000 people were coming. Now, the Sahaba's faces turned pale when they heard the word 10,000. When they heard the number, they looked at each other like, "Are you, Ya Rasulullah, you mean like what, 1,000? No, there's 10,000. 10,000, Ya Rasulullah? Ashura ta'alaf. When has Arabia ever seen 10,000? You must have made a mistake. Talha and Sa'id and their intelligence, crusades must have made a mistake. They must have, no, it can't be 10,000. Yeah, it's 10,000. Ya Rasulullah, there's no tribe that has 10,000 people. The thing is, it's not one tribe. It's 3,000 from Quraysh and 3,000 from Qatafan and 400 from Sulaym and 300 from Ashja'a and 50 people from here and 100 people from there, all together 10,000 people. And the Sahaba looking like, everyone? Yes, everyone. Everyone has come to kill us. Everyone. Concerning? Right? Like that's probably the most concerning meeting you'll ever have. Plus the Quran actually records this story in such intensity. It's way better than whatever I'll be able to tell you. You just have to read Surah Al-Ahzab itself. Surah Al-Ahzab is the Confederates. And the army that marched to Medina is called the army of Al-Ahzab, the Confederates, meaning all the groups that came together. And the Quran records very, very precisely the psychological reaction that happened to the Sahaba and how they kind of went with it. So I'm going to tell you the story. And at the end, I'm going to read to you the verses. I'm going to explain them to you. And you're going to find that the verses are way much more beautiful. And they record things that are much more important. The lessons that you and I need to learn from this. So Sahaba are in a moment of panic and fear. And they've just been asked what to do. So everyone's giving opinions because they don't know, Ya Rasulullah, we should ask for some help. Start looking for some of the tribes around us to come and help us. And the Prophet says, well, none of the tribes, we don't want to ask people who don't believe in the deen to actually fight with us. I'm not ready for that yet. Okay, Rasulullah, then maybe we should go and sit in Uhud, sit in the mountain. Because they can't make it up the mountain. The mountain is so hard to get up, just like we did at the end of the battle of Uhud. We take everyone, we just sit in the mountain until they get bored and they leave. And the Prophet said, well, how are we going to eat, drink, or die from starvation? We don't have enough food in Medina to take up to Uhud anyways. And they come up with all these ideas. One of the ideas was actually, how would we leave, Rasulullah? We migrate north. We just take everything, we just move up north. Ask maybe the Qasasina or the Manadira, the different kingdoms that existed in the northern part of Arabia and the southern part of Syria, Lebanon. How about they maybe they can give us, they can protect us or something. Leave? We're not going to leave. We're not going to run. I'm not running. You know, Rasulullah, we only have 1,500 people who can carry a sword. Some of them were young. There are people your age that would come and say, you want to fight. And the Prophet wouldn't say, no, let me see how old you are, see how strong you were. He wouldn't, a lot of people wouldn't be accepted. They wouldn't be accepted. They would be sent home and they'd be crying because they want to strand and fight. And he needed all the people he could get, because he only had 1,500 people he could carry. Some of them very old, some of them too young. And 10,000 were marching. 10,000 were properly trained, prepared. Every tribe in Arabia sent at least one representative. So if a tribe was too small and was too busy, they at least sent one person. One of their best knights to fight. Why? Because everyone had to be a part of this. Just like they tried to kill him, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, in Medina. Remember in Mecca, they tried to kill him in Mecca? What did they do? They told, okay, let's bring a guy from each tribe, and then we'll wait for him to come out, and then we'll hit him all at the same time. And when Banu Hashim come and say, well, who killed him? They have to pay us back. Well, all of us did. You can't fight all of us. There's like 15 tribes. You can't fight all of us. And then Banu Hashim would just take the diyah, just take the money, and they would be quiet. So they want to do the same thing here. Okay, let's get all of us come together. Let's work together and go to make it out. So the Sahaba are sitting there thinking, coming up with all these ideas, what we need to do. And then a guy speaks. Now this guy, his name is Salman. In any other traditional Arabic gathering, this man would have never spoken. He would never have the guts to actually open his mouth and speak. The reason, for two reasons. First of all, he is not an Arab. That's one thing. And Arabs are known to be, or used to be before this, used to be extremely racist. And if you weren't Arab, you're not supposed to speak. The second thing is he had just freed himself from slavery. So he used to be a slave. That makes you even lower on the social hierarchy. You're not supposed to speak at all. So in any other gathering, this man would have never had the guts to actually speak. And imagine had he not spoken, what would have happened to the Muslims? It would all have ended. It would pretty much, the end of the seerah would be, or actually there would be none, you and I wouldn't be here, because how would Islam have, they would have come to Medina, destroyed this, and the story would have died right there. And that would be the end of Islam. It would be just a part of history books. Yeah, there was a small rebellion, and they killed him. Probably wouldn't make it to your history books. But this man spoke. He was allowed to speak. He had the confidence. He knew that he was respected. He knew that he was equal to those sitting around him. So he felt like he could speak. He felt it was not a problem. I can say what I want. So he said, you know, so the last thing to say. Fadlan, go ahead. What do you want to say? So he said, Ya Rasulullah, kunna ma'ashara ahli faris idha hajama alayna a'da'una wa kana kathwa wa kunna qilla khandaqna hawla anfusina. Oh, Ya Rasulullah, you see, when we used to be people of Persia, he's Persian, he comes from Persia. He's called Salman the Persian, Salman the Faris. He came from Persia. Persia is what is Iran today. I'll talk about that in a moment. And you say, Ya Rasulullah, we used to live there. I remember that if we were raided by we knew that we were going to be raided by a tribe or by a country that was stronger than us, and we were smaller in numbers, lesser in numbers, and they were more than us, what we did was we would trench around each other, around ourselves. So he used the word khandaq, which is a noun. He used that as a verb. He said khandaqna, which is not actually, that shows his Arabic isn't 100%. But khandaqna hawla anfusina, that's what he said. So the Sahaba kind of giggled. Some of the Sahaba laughed. Some of the Sahaba, not knowing whether he was serious or joking, they laughed. They thought it was a joke. You know, whenever, you know, sometimes it happens, you're in a group and some guy says something and he's serious and you laugh because it's hilarious because it's so dumb. And then you're like, oh, you're serious. Okay. That makes it even funnier. What are you saying? So some of the Sahaba, when he said this, they laughed. Like, dig a trench around Medina. Listen to this guy. And everyone's like giggling, chuckling. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Let's dig a trench around Medina. And then they look at, and Salman is like totally serious. But the Prophet said, he was thinking, no, wait. Hold on, let's just, so tell me, how did you do it? So Salman starts to explain. So we would get pickets and shovels and we would go into the ground and we make it like a good couple of meters wide, a couple of meters deep, and we'd make sure all the rubble would come on the side of where we would be. We would sit on the other side and we would guard the trench that we would dig, and they couldn't make it to our side. And the Sahaba were like, what? Is he serious? Is he considering this? Now, before I continue the story, I've always found it amazing or astonishing how open-minded the Prophet ﷺ is. You see, this is a foreign idea from a foreign person. Usually people who are a bit older in age don't like foreign things. If you're older in age, you know exactly what I'm talking to you about. If your father's older in age, you know what I'm talking about too. Usually people are a bit older, they get set in their ways. They don't like new things. They don't like new anything, really. They're not open to any new ideas or any... Yeah, a new phone to them is offensive. A new channel to them on TV is bothersome. Everything that is new is just, that's not how we used to do it. The way they used to do it is way better. But it never is. But that's what they say anyway, right? It's always, the new stuff are horrible. And then you're stuck, well, I'm new. Am I horrible? You'll probably say yes at that point. But anyways, this is the idea that they don't like new things. The Prophet ﷺ is, how old is he now? This is the fifth year of his hijrah. How old is he? Can someone do the math for me quickly?
45?
Yeah, he became a prophet at 40. Then he stayed in Mecca for how many years? 13. So that's how many? 53. Now 5 years over. So 58. 58, 59. So I'm saying that. He's getting older. Yet he's the most open-minded person in the group. There are people who are younger who weren't open-minded to the idea of Salman. Not just because it's foreign, but because it was extremely tiring, that's why. Because we'll talk about this in a moment. You're not going to like what this actually means in terms of trenching around themselves, what this is going to indicate. But the Prophet ﷺ was very open-minded. And he appreciated authentic, original ideas. If you had something to say that was new and different, he wanted to listen to it, I saw. So he wasn't set in his ways. He didn't think that things had to be always done in a certain way. He wasn't closed-minded. I hate the fact that when we try to follow him, somehow when you're following him, you end up closed-minded, and it doesn't make any sense. If you were truly following him, you would take from him the fact that he was such an open-minded human being, that he listened to people and listened to their experiences, and he took from it the khayr that he could take from it. And I can't think of a better example than the story of Al-Khandaq, because this is the most bizarre idea I'd ever heard of. Seriously, think of the idea of digging a trench around a city. It makes no sense at all. And it's a bizarre concept. Yet he's open-minded enough to say, let's just think. Maybe this may work. Because he has a few pieces of information that the Sahaba haven't thought about yet. But to actually consider it shows you a certain level of open-mindedness that I don't know that, you know, exists that well in the world. And it bothers me if you follow him, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, you love him, you want to be like him, you end up closed-minded. You're someone who, you know, I knew, you refuse something just because it's new. Not because it's wrong, but because it's new. Newness is not a criteria for refusal of anything, really. So you'll, and you can see how the Sahaba are very flexible as well. They're a flexible community. They didn't like it at the beginning. But it's going to grow on to you in a second. Because they're like, you know, so what are you talking about? Dig a trench? We don't know. We don't know how to dig. We're not construction workers. How do you do this? It's impossible. It's not like you're living on the beach in Medina where it's just like, it's just sand. No, this is rock. We have very primitive tools. It's just a picket and a shovel. And we don't have a pick and a shovel and another chisel, whatever, all this other stuff that they, very simple things, very simple, simple stuff that they're going to use. And this is going to take an insane amount of time. Get the Prophet, so I said, I was like, hold on, let me explain to you. So do you have some of the pictures coming up? All right. So the way Medina works is like this. Medina is historically known to be a city, Bayna Harratain, or Bayna Nabatain. Between two pieces of land from the east and the west that are literally dead land that you cannot do anything in. You can't grow anything in it, you can't live on it, you can't walk on it, nothing can march on this, not even tanks today, not even modern cars and modern armies can actually move on these, on the Harrat Waqim and Harrat Nabira. You'll come up in a moment, I'll show them to you. And these two Harrat are basically just volcanic rock. What happened there historically, I am not 100% sure, I don't know why. But this is just black rock that is extremely, extremely deep. Between each rock and the other is an extremely deep fall. You could easily slip into one of them and never be found. I remember my dad had a friend named Brother Abdullah, a very nice man. He used to take me, he was a historian. He used to take me all around Medina showing me all these things, and he was an amazing guy. He gave me an Arabic sword that I still have in Syria. And he took me to Hawa, and he took a rock and he dropped it. And he told me to time. So I timed. I timed 7 seconds before it hit something. I timed 7 seconds where I actually hit something down there. You could easily slip into it and never be found ever again. The Harra is just amazing. If you ever go to Medina, ask to be taken there. Just to go see it and observe it. So really from the east and the west, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has protected Medina. You can't enter from the east or the west. Now the southern part are just walls. The walls of the three tribes, of Banu Qurayza, Banu Nadir, and Banu Qaynuqa. Their walls and their forts and their castles are literally plugging up the southern part of Medina. So you cannot enter the southern from Medina from the south unless they open these huge gates. And the gates were huge. I'm talking about, you know, bigger than that wall. Sometimes some of these doors were way higher and way wider than the walls of the masjid. Huge doors. You could not penetrate them no matter what you did. So if they didn't want to open up, you weren't getting in. So the only part of Medina that is accessible is the north. That's it. Now that the Prophet was like, yeah. Well, we already have agreements with the Jewish tribes in the south not to open the doors because they're going to help us defend Medina. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has defended Medina for them, the east and the west for us. So all we need to do is really defend the north. So tell me again, Salman, how did you guys dig this? And Salman starts to explain. And the Sahaba are now doing simple math and arithmetic in their minds. How wide is the northern opening of Medina? You know how wide it is? It's 5 kilometers wide. It's 5 kilometers. Now, in order for them to dig something that is worth it, do we have tape? Did anyone bring
right there.
Tape? Perfect. All right, to the top. In order for this to be big enough, all right? So it has to be 5 kilometers wide. So if this is Medina, let's say this is a small, miniature Medina. So you guys are living in Medina. This is the northern part of Medina, and you have the Harra is that wall, and the Harra is that wall, and the forts are right there. And this is the northern part of Medina, right? So you would have to dig a trench from this side over here, from where the Harra begins on the left, on the west, to where the Harra begins over there on the east. And this is going to be a 5 kilometer trench. Now, in order for it to work, because if they dig it, maybe if this is how big it's going to be. Then easily the person who comes just has to pick up his galabiya and just go like this, and then he's on the other side of it. So it's not going to work. You have to have it wide enough, and you have to have it deep enough in order for this to actually work. So how deep and wide does it have to be? So we're not sure 100%, but I'm going to give you the basic idea. Yeah, go ahead.
4 meters wide.
Yeah, and around 3 meters deep, right? So it has to be 3 meters deep. So, well, I'll talk about this again. Let's talk about the width. Hold this. This is how wide. So you can have to stand over here, right? Because this is that's the eastern side of Medina. This is the western side of Medina, and we're going to put a 5-kilometer trench. This is how wide this has to be. So it has to be 4 meters wide or 3 meters wide. I think it was 3 meters wide and 4 meters deep. We're not 100% sure, but something like that. So this here is, what is this? So right here. So here's 400. This is how wide the trench has to be. I understand what I'm saying? This is how wide it has to be. Why don't you look at that for a moment? You see how wide this has to be? Come this way. This is how wide the trench needs to be. Why? Because if I am coming from Quraysh and I'm jogging, so this is how wide it has to be, or else my horse can just jump, because horses can jump and some of them are well trained. Or I can get a couple of pieces of wood and just put them from one side to the other and the people can just run on it. So it has to be 4 meters wide for this to work. Imagine, like, there's a hole between me and Muhammad that's 4 meters wide. And then it has to be 3 meters deep. So let's bring this down to 3 meters. I'm not sure how we're going to do this, but, alright. Sure. Actually, I wanted to see if this would stand. Would this stand up? Some of them are really quite, no? Some of them are pretty, No. Some of them are pretty strong. If you can get them to, I just want you guys to have an idea of how high this would be.
Alright.
Almost. I understand what I'm trying to say. You get the idea. This is how deep this has to be.
It's taller than.
In order for this to work, you're going to need a 4-meter wide trench and a 3-meter deep trench, right? In order for the horses not to just come and just, it'll be like, because if you don't do it that way, it'll just be a sport for the horses. The horses just come, oh look, we have like a little, you know, okay, let's jump, and the horses just go jumping onto the side, and it's really nothing. You just gave the horses some extra exercise. If you actually want to get this done, it has to be deep enough so that the horses fall in, they die, or if someone falls into this, they actually die, and it has to be wide enough for them not to be able to jump across it. It's going to be so big and so wide. When I tell you the story, there's actually going to be a battle that's going to happen inside the trench. Remember that part?
Yeah.
So Ali, there's going to be a battle. Two people are going to stand and they're going to fight. That's how big the trench is going to be. Now, here comes the math part. So I want you, if you have your phone, you can take your phone. That's okay, you can cheat. Yes?
So, before we couldn't they just stand on the house?
So all the rubble that comes from this digging, where is it going to go? On the Muslim side. So there's another mountain of rubble on the Muslim side. So now it's 3 meters deep, and then another 2 or 1.5 meters deep of rubble on the other side, so it's impossible. They can't do it anymore. They can't make it. That's what they had to do, it like that. Now the interesting part of the math is actually, let's see how much it's going to be. So how many cubic meters is this trench going to look like? So 5,000 meters times 3 times 4. So what is this going to turn into? So 60,000 cubic meters, right? That's you know how huge that is? That's really, really big. I don't know exactly what to draw a proper simile, but I'm going to do something a bit more interesting for you. There's going to be 1,500 people working at this trench, right? The Prophet ﷺ, the way he's going to have it divided, 60 groups, each group 25 people. Each group has a leader, and they're going to be given around 83 meters to dig. So they're going to be given, this is a 5-kilometer trench, 25 people are going to be assigned 83 meters to dig. You have to dig these 83 meters. To make this as efficient as possible, the Prophet ﷺ told them this, you will dig it and you will defend it. So if you don't dig properly and they come through from your side, you're the first person to get killed. So you're going to dig it and defend it. So you better dig well so that they don't come, they don't enter Medina from your side. Perfect, there you go. So let's go back to that picture again. The one that it's okay, or whatever you want. You're going backwards. Alright. Okay, so take a look. So you can see Halat Wafel on the eastern side and Halat Al-Babra. You you see? On the western side. And down here, way over down here, yeah, this is where it's not in the picture, this picture, but that's where the forts and the castles and the walls of the Jewish tribe existed. And then up there, go back to the other picture, that picture is nice, yeah, this one here. Yeah. And then you can see where the Khandaq is going. See where the Khandaq? They can't go in. That makes sense with the Prophet ﷺ. Imagine how much information the Prophet ﷺ had from a geographical point of view to know this. You know, he's a leader, ﷺ, that a very exceptional person. He knew the geography, but I've been living in London for 5 years. I don't know how to get to Wharncliffe and commissioners told me. I don't know. I don't even know if they actually intersect or not. I know nothing. The Prophet ﷺ knew the geography of a city that he was never born in. He's not a part of, but he knows exactly how the city works. To actually make this idea, this isn't a state idea. I don't know if you appreciate how bizarre this idea actually is, to dig a 5 kilometer trench. But we'll get there. Let's keep on going. So the same thing, so Banu Qurayza here at the southern part, and the Ahzab are going to come over there from the number is wrong, it's not 3,000, it's only 1,500 people. The number of Muslims in Medina were 3,000. But not all of them could actually fight, only 1,500 could. Very good, that's another picture right there. I think there was another one that you had that was nice. Go forward a bit. Yeah, that was a good one. So you can see Harrat Waqim. And Harrat Wabra on the eastern, and then Jabal Eir down there, that's where all the forts and the castles exist, so you can't get in. And all that they had to do is just close up that northern part. Keep on going. I think there's one more, yeah. Is that the end of it? Zagallah. Very good. Pause that's good enough. You can leave it like that. So that's where the Khandaq is going to be. And Jabal Sala is very important right there. So that's the mountain of Sala. It's going to be an important part of this story. So let's do the math again. So if you have 60,000 cubic meters that you need to, be done, of course you only have 10 days to do it. They're going to be on the outskirts of Medina in 15 days. The Confederates are going to make it in 15 days. So the Prophet ﷺ is not going to finish his job in 15 days. They can't arrive and be like, hold on, just wait for a second, we have to finish this last couple of meters of digging. No, you have to be done and prepared and ready before they actually make it here. So they had to finish this in 10 days. So they had 10 days to dig 60,000 cubic meters. Now, there's only 1,500 people who are digging. Who can do the math? How much do you need to dig?
40
cubic meters, right? What is 40 cubic meters? This is easy. I can tell you what 40 cubic meters. 40 cubic meters is your room. That is the volume of your room. When you go home tonight and you lie down in a room, when you look around, what you see is, give or take, 40 cubic meters, that's what it is. Because usually most rooms are 4x3x4 or 4x3x3, something like that. So it's around 40 cubic meters. So basically, if you were standing there with Salman, now you understand what the Sahaba, when they heard Salman say, they laughed. What are you talking about? I'm going to have to dig 40 cubic meters in 10 days with a shovel and a pick. That's it's all rock. Medina's everything. Till this day, if you go to Medina, the land is just pure rock. You'd have to dig the volume of your room. Imagine digging your room in your backyard. Digging a hole big enough, as big as your room, yeah?
Well, is the Khandaq still there?
Oh, well, of course not. Come on. It would be nice, but wouldn't it? I'm going to tell you this. I actually did this in Syria. I've given this numerous times. So I remember I gave something similar, and I told people, how about we try this? And I got volunteers. I got 10 volunteers. They're all Shabab in high school, grade 11 and 12. And we went out, because I come from a country that's just all mountains. If you come from Lebanon and Jordan and Syria, it's just mountains everywhere. So we actually took out, took shovels, and we took picks, and we went up to the mountain, and I took with me the tape, and we... And we